Today is Friday, April 27th. And just let folks know, we're not going to, there's been a couple bills been dropped off, or House Bill 2018. We'll not have a work session today. Okay. I will open up a work session on House Bill 3488. Kat, can you give a refresher on the bill?
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think we have an amendment.
We do have two.
Okay.
House Bill 3488 expands the business energy tax credit to include credit for renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities. We have Amendment 3488-1, and that allows a public utility to charge a rate to provide no-interest loans to customers who install renewable energy generation facilities in their homes. And then House Bill 3488-2 amendment corrects a drafting error that Rep. Cannon caught on page 6 is just changing 4 to 4.
Okay. Are there any questions? Any discussion? Representative Cannon?
Madam Chair, I move the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3488.
Representative Cannon moves the dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3488. Any discussion? Any objections? Okay, seeing none, the dash ones are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3488.
Representative Cannon moves the dash 2s to House Bill 3488. And just a reminder, colleagues, that this is being referred to the Revenue Committee. After that, any questions or discussions?
One letter makes a big difference.
Thank you for catching that. Okay. Any objections to adopting the dash 2s? Seeing none, the dash 2s are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3488 as amended by the dash 1 and dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Revenue Committee by prior reference.
Okay. Representative Cannon moves adoption of the dash 1s and dash 2s to House Bill 3488. With a due pass recommendation to the Revenue Committee. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Okay. Seeing none, House Bill 3488 with the dash 1s and dash 2s is adopted and moves to the Revenue Committee. Okay. With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3488, and I will open up a work session on House Bill 3525.
Madam Chair.
Cannon.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3525 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Madam Chair, I'd like to amend that motion to send it out with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, there's a motion on the floor for, first we'll have a discussion of the first motion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I am not comfortable with this bill as drafted. I think we need additional time and consideration of this. Of course, as members know, we're up against a deadline of end of the month, and I think that this opportunity to move it on to Ways and Means without recommendation will give folks a chance to work through this, to consider any possible amendments, and to make it a better bill if that's the direction it ends up heading.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Any other discussions?
Madam Chair, I'm voting for this regardless of how it goes down, and I'm not really sure whether a recommendation or no recommendation really is going to have that much impact on what happens to this bill after it leaves the committee, so I'm willing to vote for this amendment.
For the motion or
the motion, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So any other discussion on House Bill 3525 on the amendment from the motion from Representative Cannon?
Madam Chair, there are some significant merits, I think, in this proposal, particularly with respect to the use of wintertime flow to recharge depleted aquifers. So I think there's a core idea to this bill that I think just deserves more attention. But there were some other concerns about the bill, so I would say that the interplay between those is such that I would not be comfortable with a due pass recommendation at this point, but do support getting the bill on so it can get further consideration. So I will oppose the motion to amend, but I certainly favor that this bill moving forward so it can get to the fullest kind of attention.
Okay. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I appreciate you raising that. I have share some of the same concerns. I think that there was discussion about alternatives analysis, which I still did not receive the information for, and so that was a concern that I had, that we didn't really have enough information to make a recommendation on that, and I think that this absolutely needs more discussion. So I will support the motion to send this to the Ways and Means without recommendation. Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about House Bill 3525. Colleagues, the reason for my recommendation is House Bill 3525 comes with strong bipartisan support in the House, and this is a bill that when we vote counted it, we know we have the votes to pass it on the floor. And so I think this is an opportunity for this committee to step up and to recognize that the entire state of Oregon is important and that agriculture and our natural industry partners are important, and to send them a message that we care about them, we care about the future of the ag industry in the state of Oregon, and how best to do that than to send a strong message with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative Smith. So there's a motion to amend. Representative Smith moves to amend the motion by substituting a motion to move bill. Trying to make sure I get this right. The due pass recommendation to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on Representative Smith's motion? Okay, I think we've sort of had that discussion. Representative Jensen, you want to add anything?
Thank you. I don't think there's, that much, Madam Chair, to add to Representative Smith's testimony and support of this. I think Representative Smith is correct, and I would just use the ditto marks if that's all right with the Chair.
Okay, so noted.
Okay, the clerk will call.
Okay, those of the opinion that the motion be amended by substituting Representative Smith's motion for what Representative Cannon had recommended, which is a due pass recommendation, and without, actually we're voting right now on the due pass, will say aye, and those opposed say no. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Aye.
Representative Cannon?
No.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Chair Dinkelder?
No. Okay, so the motion carries, and the House Bill, so that substitutes for the original motion, and House Bill...
It doesn't pass. Now you have to take a vote on...
Now, Madam Chair.
Right, so now...
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I checked with Ramon on this, and I'm not a parliamentarian in any way. Apparently now I need to move the amended...
Right, so this... So the amended... Motion. The amendment... to the motion has passed for House Bill 3525 and has received a majority now.
Okay. So now, Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3525 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
With the referral amended. To
Ways and Means.
Yeah. The bill's not amended.
It's not amended. You don't need the amendment in the motion. You're just
you share with me the script and I'll say what I need to say, Kat.
You just need to. Where's
you
the
just you can just tell him the
oh,
the correct
just say
motion.
You just move. I'll get them mine.
We'll get this straight.
I'm not really, truly not have a repeat of yesterday. Yeah, I just don't
you
know how to do this.
You move this with the
okay. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3525 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, Representative Smith has made a motion to refer House Bill 3525 to the Ways and Means Committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I will support that motion. As I say, I think there's a core idea in the bill, which is to use the water that's coming down the Columbia effectively. I would say that I don't think the bill in its form that it came through our committee is in shape to do just what it ought to do, but I would say something that would be confined in a way that would be using seasonal flows effectively is something I would support, and I would urge those who are proponents of the bill to make work this bill further so that it accomplishes that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will oppose the motion. I am certainly appreciative of the challenges facing, in particular, the area that would benefit from this from an economic development standpoint. But I have a couple of concerns, and one of them just simply has to do with the nature of the relationship between Oregon and the other states that draw from the Columbia, and my concern about jeopardizing the what may be, and I again, I just feel like I haven't heard enough testimony on this, but maybe a sort of tenuous neatly balanced relationship there, one that I think in our perspective, from an Oregonian's perspective, might look unfair, but nevertheless one that is the subject of quite a bit of understanding between the states. And I guess as a teacher, when we have disputes on the playground and one kid, you know, one class decides it's going to go and do something its own way, our hope is that the other class doesn't then simply do the same thing. And I guess keeping this within the framework of the understanding that the states have had seems really, really important, and I'm really concerned about an incautious and imprudent step here on Oregon's part. So I will oppose this motion.
Thank you, Representative Cannon. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I want to be very brief with this and speak just a little bit to the good representative's issues and concerns with this. I would remind this committee that there is a Columbia River governance group with the CSG West, Council of State Governments West, and that governance committee consists of that committee consists of the states that water either in the Columbia River either originate from or flows through, which would include then the states of Idaho, Montana, Washington, and Oregon. This has been something of a topic in that committee, and it certainly is important and imperative, and I agree with the representative, and I agree with his and understand his concerns, though I'm starting to say agree with him. I understand his concerns, and they are justifiable concerns. I believe our other states are more or less familiar with the whole process of this, and would remind the members of the committee that the state of Washington has done something similar to what we're doing or proposing to do here in the past. I say something similar to because I don't want to equate it as equal. That remains for a longer discussion, but at least there's great similarity to it. So I do appreciate the representative's concern and respect him for that. But nevertheless, I would still be voting yes on the bill.
And Representative Byer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been really on the fence on this issue because I really do see both sides of this issue, and in trying to figure out which way to come. In the testimony, I think I was a little disappointed that what has been done to date has been not a lot, and what's happening has been really slow, and maybe that's just the way it has to be. But I'm hoping that the discussion on this and whatever happens after this maybe can speed up the efforts to solve the problem that this area is having with water. And if we can accomplish that, then I think that we're doing a good thing.
Okay. Any other discussion? I will say for the record that as the during the hearings here, I have some concerns about the fact that there hasn't been a full vetting of this alternative, that there hasn't been the proper environmental studies that have been done to see how this alternative fares with other alternatives, such as, I think, what my colleague mentioned, the withdrawal of water during the winter, which is a viable option that right now does not need any additional permits or additional approval by the state, which is available to the proponents of this bill right now. The other concern I have is potential legal costs, which really hasn't been brought up here, but there is concern about if a project like this move forward, the impact to either the biological opinion, which has been negotiated with federal agencies, and also agreements with other states. The fiscal on this is pretty hefty, and being on the Budget Committee, I know that we don't have the dollars in the state to fight years and years of legal fees, which is a potential if the bill in its current form would pass. And then finally, we heard from pretty strong objection from our sovereign tribes that they have concerns about how this will affect projects that are currently in the Umatilla Basin. I'm very familiar with the Phase 1 and Phase 2 projects, and the tribes, to their credit, have worked long and hard with many of the other concerned parties in this area to try to solve problems. And that's one of the reasons I have concerns about this bill, is that it is not a consensus bill. And I think that we really try, I know, we try hard to move forward with consensus here whenever we can, and there was not, from the testimony that we heard, enough discussion with some of the members who could be impacted. Finally, I did hear from one of the proponents of the bill that they, who actually was a co-sponsor of the bill, that she has been hearing a lot from her constituents, who are a lot of fishermen, that they're concerned about the potential downriver impacts if these flows, especially during the summer, are reduced. So those are some of the concerns that I have, and that's why I'll be voting no. We have a motion to on the table, and will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Byer?
Aye.
Representative Jim?
Aye.
Representative Burley?
Yes.
Representative Cannon?
No.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Chair Dinkfelder?
No. Okay. The motion carries, and the bill is referred to the Ways and Means Committee. And with that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3525. And now we will open a work session. Actually, we're going to open up public hearings, a continuation of the public hearings on House Bill 3543, House Bill 2859, and House Bill 3545. We had a number of people that were here to testify on Wednesday and could not show up. So we're going to call, and then also hopefully we have a sign-up sheet if there's additional people here. First, I would like to call up Greg Miller and Michael Early, and you can testify on any of these three bills. Is there anybody here that wants to testify? Greg Miller? Okay, they're not here. We also had... Okay, Greg, you're up. Okay. And then, let's see, Scott Bolton. Scott here. Let's see, Scott. Gary Bauer. Gary. And I don't know if Tom O'Connor is back yet. I know some people could come back and some couldn't. Dave Robertson. Is Dave in this? Okay. So you guys can, any...
Okay, thank you very much. For the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Greg Miller. I'm the Public Affairs Manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. I'd also bring with you to you my hat as a member of the Governor's Climate Change Integration Group. I will keep this very brief for you. I understand that there are amendments. We're working on amendments, and there's a work group in place, and we've been meeting diligently. I believe that this is moving forward in the right direction. We're about 95% there with the amendments and the language for 3543. House Bill 3543. So I'm really encouraged by this progress and hope that when we come back with a completed package, we can be in full support, subject to looking at the final language. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. I appreciate the opportunity to comment this afternoon, and I'll be fairly brief. We've been working on this issue for a number of years. Actually, our president of our company was asked by the governor to co-chair his governor's advisory group a few years ago, which started off a lot of the state discussions on this topic, and we continue to participate in other activities as well. What we found is whether you agree or disagree with the science and the topic, our research shows that 72% of our customers are either very or somewhat concerned about global warming, and they expect our utility to get involved and actually try to address the issue. We know that natural gas will be a key element in trying to address global warming. It's natural gas produces half the CO2 emissions of coal and a third less than fuel oil. So as a result, we know that there will be a lot of interest in using natural gas for basically some additional generation by electric utilities. While we think that is good and it's a good bridge approach, we also think that it's important that natural gas be used as wisely and efficiently as possible. And to us, that means you use it as much as you can directly at what we call the burner tip, so using it directly to heat homes and heat water. It is much more efficient that way than generating electricity and others. To share with you, we have been doing a lot with energy efficiency. We've cut customer usage by 18% per home in the last decade, and are continuing to double these other savings on an annual basis. Just briefly, I'll kind of cut through this. While we think we agree with 3543, as Mr. Miller just said, it's moving in the right direction. One of the comments I wanted to make that we believe it's important, as you look at a makeup for the commission that is discussing that legislation, that it adequately represent the various interest groups. What we have found in the efforts that we've done is, and in working with our customers, that not all of our customer organizations that we work with have the same view on how to approach the issue. And so, again, we think it's very important that that commission adequately represent all of the different views. In addition, we support establishing the Oregon Climate Research Institute. Again, we think it's important for Oregon to continue to understand the issue and move forward on it. Considerable discussion over the past few months regarding the cap-and-trade approach to this issue. We have proposed to the governor's office that they include in the legislation, if possible, some language that clarifies that that they should consider a similar approach that was identified in the carbon allocation task force, sorry, keeping all my acronyms and names straight, on how to approach natural gas. We do not have an alternative. We don't have some other fuel we can put into our system, and so we're actually looking a lot at energy efficiency to help meet our needs on that. And again, in terms of the other legislation and concepts, they're very complicated. There's a lot of discussion, I think, that needs to continue with those, and we'd like to participate in that as you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any quick questions? We have a lot of people want to testify today, so I'm going to try to keep our questions to a minimum. Thank you, gentlemen. And I'm just going to ask people if they can keep their comments to 2 minutes because we want to try to make sure and get everybody up here. And, of course, you're welcome to submit written comments as well. If you have written comments, you just hand them to the committee administrator. But we have a lot of people. I want to make sure that we get everybody in. Okay, next we have Tom O'Connor is here, Tom, and Sally Schoenger-Kraus and Jeremiah Bauman.
Not Jeremiah.
It's not me, Jeremiah, that man.
Okay, you have 2 minutes, and we have a timer, so I'm flashing at you. You're like the military here. Okay, and be disciplined. Tom,
thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. I also was a member of the Governor's Carbon Allocation Task Force over this last year. Briefly, as far as these three bills are concerned, we agree that 3543 is a good thing to go forward with. It advances the ball, gets the discussion going, gives us a vehicle to get at some of the tough issues that are associated with this issue, particularly the cap and trade approach and the emissions performance standard. I handed out a couple of pieces there. We've been doing a lot of work, trying to do a lot of work, both regionally and nationally, on the climate change issues. The piece there from the that has the PNUCC logo is an organization that represents both public and private utilities in the Northwest. It's principles that we've adopted to look at federal climate change legislation. The second part of the packet is the resolution that the American Public Power Association has adopted with our approaches on climate change. I guess just to sum up, On the two, we would support 3543 going forward. We think that 3545 and 2859 do need more work. 3545, for example, I did serve on the task force, but I just don't think this version needs more work. For example, it's as is right now, it's electric only. We feel very strongly that this needs to be an industry-wide approach, not only utilities, but also all emitters of greenhouse gas. If you're going to set up a cap-and-trade mechanism, that's important. The other part is I think we really need to seriously look at whether you can have a one-state cap-and-trade mechanism or, better, how we meld into a regional or national approach. On the emissions performance standard, again, we're certainly willing to work on that. I think the Washington legislation that passed has some good language in it as far as we're concerned and the way it treats municipal utilities. We'd like to look at that. So that's, I guess, in sum, our feelings about the three bills.
Thank you. Let's go next. Sally.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sally Schillinger-Krause, and I'm the Program Director for Global Warming at the Oregon Environmental Council, and I'm also a member of the Governor's Climate Change Integration Group. Thank you for holding this hearing and for the opportunity to speak. It's an honor to be here. Over the last 20 years, global warming has emerged as one of the foremost concerns of our time, and Oregon has the opportunity now to demonstrate that solutions are at hand if only we have the foresight to adopt them. House Bills 3543, 2859, and 3545 represent a comprehensive set of policies and measures designed to continue the trajectory of global warming action first laid out in the 2004 release of the Oregon Strategy for Greenhouse Gas Reductions. The strategy, as I'm sure you all know, was the result of a year-long multi-stakeholder process. And they made approximately 70 recommendations that will bring Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions to a level hovering just over 1990 levels, and that will start us on a downward trend, the ultimate goal being 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. Since the strategy was released in 2005, Oregon has begun implementing those recommendations, including adopting the tailpipe emission standards in June of 2006. And the joint committees are also now simultaneously considering other recommendations made by the advisory group, which are the Renewable Energy Standard, the Biofuels Package, and other bills related to the development of clean energy technologies and implementation of energy efficiency. And while these bills are in themselves a very dramatic step in addressing global warming, they only bring us part way to our eventual destination. So the Climate Change Integration Act, the Power Plant Performance Standard, and the Carbon Cap and Trace System take us further. And by taking the initiative now, Oregon actually has the opportunity to position itself as a leader, not a follower, on climate policy. We have the opportunity to offer models for specific policy options that may be later adopted at a regional or national level. And the experience and expertise that we bring to the broader table will help to ensure both that Oregon's diverse interests are protected and that she will maintain her competitiveness as we move forward into a carbon-reduced economy. And I'd like to close by a personal observation. For the last 12 years, OEC has sponsored a business and environment forum series. And a couple of days ago, I attended one of them, which addressed the greening of Oregon's economy, which is a movement that is gradually becoming as much of a state icon as Mount Hood. And one of the questions at the end of the morning had to do with whether there is a point at which we will overreach ourselves, whether we would reach a point where too much initiative and too much sustainability was too much of a good thing. And the overwhelming response from the panelists all of whom were representatives of prosperous Oregon companies, was an unequivocal no. And one panelist in particular said we should not be deterred by the challenges of becoming greener. And I believe that the same may be said with regard to climate legislation. We need to start somewhere. We need to start here. And on behalf of OEC, I recommend that, I urge that the joint committees move all three bills forward for full consideration by the Oregon State Legislature. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Augsburg. I'll keep this very brief and just speak specifically to the policy contained in the bills. I will repeat this note you've heard a lot about, the opportunity to take leadership on this issue, not because of the feel-good reasons or because we can take pride in that, though we certainly can, but because there's a policy reason to do so, which is that we're entering a whole new world of regulation over the course of the next, you know, 3 to 10 years, and things are going to change a lot for businesses across the country and across the world. But getting out in front and figuring out what the right policy is for reducing global warming pollution, our businesses will have a competitive advantage as federal and federal programs come into play. So I think it's important for that policy reason. The second reason is it's important, and it's an important opportunity for Oregon to play a role in crafting the right policy. The idea of of being allowed to trade pollution credits back and forth is a smart economic policy for a pollution that doesn't have local impacts, but it's also extraordinarily complicated. And there's an opportunity here for Oregon to avoid some of the problems that have come up in other states and in other countries where this policy has been started. The Carbon Allocation Task Force, which I served, spent 14 months developing this, and I think a couple of good things have happened in the policy that is there, although certainly we're happy to keep discussing it and working on it. First is it's got a lot of flexibility mechanisms to make this a manageable policy for businesses in terms of how it's enforced, in terms of the different tools businesses have to reduce their global warming pollution. Secondly, it avoids a lot of the loopholes and challenges that have come up in other attempts to develop cap-and-trade systems. My third point is sort of a category in that second point, which is that this would be the first in the country that is a load-based cap-and-trade system. What that means is that because our utilities are still vertically integrated, we're telling the utilities that sell the electricity for the electric-only portion of the cap-and-trade that they're the ones who have to reduce the global warming pollution associated with the electricity they sell. On the East Coast, because a lot of the utilities are no longer vertically integrated, there's a policy difficulty, which is generator-based cap-and-trade. So they're telling an owner of a coal-fired power plant who doesn't sell electricity except to another utility that they need to reduce global warming pollution. Well, aside from some efficiencies at that coal plant, it's very hard for them to implement the best tools, which are efficiencies on the consumer and business end, the electricity users end, and the renewable energy, which if you're the owner of a coal-fired power plant, there's not a whole lot you can do to make your coal turn into wind. So the load-based system just eliminates a lot of the difficulties, a lot of the complexity, and really puts the incentives in the right place to use the right tools, which are energy efficiency and renewable energy. Let me then just wrap up by talking about the emissions performance standard. This bill probably looks complicated, but I see it as actually a relatively simple tool because it simply says until we've got a comprehensive global warming program in place, we don't want to invest in the biggest sources of global warming pollution when we know this is the highest risk time to do so because we don't know what the federal rules are going to be. We don't know what the state or regional rules are going to be. It goes back to a saying you hear attributed everywhere, which is the first thing you do when you realize you're digging yourself into a hole is stop digging. This policy says let's just stop digging for a little while while we figure out how to solve these problems. And so let's just not invest in these high polluting resources in the future.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any quick questions from
the panel? Madam Chair, quick question. Thank you. Given the extraordinary spike where the world is experiencing in CO2 emissions, given greenhouse gas emissions generally, given the business opportunity that we have now, are these goals, 2010, 2050, for greenhouse gas emission reductions enough? Do they go far enough to really take on this problem in a meaningful way?
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
I'll step up, I guess. Back waiting for you. Okay.
I'm leaning forward closest to the microphone. That single topic is probably the most hotly debated question in the scientific community right now. Various states and regions have set goals that range anywhere from 50% reductions by 2050 to 80% reductions by 2050. I sat in on a two-day meeting where scientists and policymakers were literally just crunching through all the numbers. And, one of the scientists, one of the leading scientists, James Hansen from NASA, was arguing that at a 75% reduction by 2050, you basically have 50-50 odds of avoiding the most catastrophic consequences. So that's the main debate, is whether those goals are high enough or they need to be higher. Certainly, I think at this point, there's an agreement among a lot of the policy experts I've talked to that the short-term goal is the most important one. Getting significant reductions below 1990 levels by 2020, that 10% is a good benchmark, and that short-term is the most important piece, because unless we start that and start it quickly, then the long-term reductions by 2050 only get harder and steeper if we don't get the short-term direction changed. I think there are some people who are saying, let's not spend a whole lot more time debating 75% versus 90 by 2050. Let's get policies in place to get us down by 2020.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? All right, thank you very much. Next up, I guess Dave Robertson is here. And Jason Eisdorfer. You're coming up, Jeff, instead. And I don't see Scott Fulton. So I will call up Catherine Bonetta. Catherine Bonetta here. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that side. Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, sitting in for my colleague Jason Eisdorfer, who was scheduled to be here. He's somewhere else in the building working on another issue. Very briefly, I'll just echo a couple of points that have already been made, one by Mr. Bauer of Northwest Natural, is that we are seeing a growing awareness and a growing concern by our members who are customers of both natural gas and electric utilities on these issues, and wanting effective addressing and reduction of carbon emissions. And that is something that, again, we've been seeing growing very dramatically over the last couple of years. And as we go out and talk to our members and to civic organizations, community groups, where we used to maybe get a question, one out of every 100 questions, they're now coming much more frequently, and it's very unusual to leave a public presentation without having to discuss the issue at least at some level. We, too, very much support House Bill 3543 and moving that forward. We think it provides a good framework to start working through these issues and making sure that Oregon has the infrastructure to kind of deal with these issues. We're also very interested in the other bills, 3545 and 2859. Thank you. And there's been a lot of good work done on them in the governor's working groups, and we think that we hope to see that work continue here in the legislature. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Robertson. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Portland General Electric. Thanks for the opportunity to testify on these three bills this year. PG spent a lot of time over the last few years studying this carbon issue and what we should do. We've spent a lot of time in the last year particularly meeting with our customers, looking at the science, having our folks in the resource planning shop run the numbers and figure out what works best for us. And our conclusion is, there's a train moving down the track, and it's called carbon regulation. And we actually believe it's best to get ahead of that, help get on board, and try to steer it a little bit. We do think it's time for carbon regulation in the U.S. We think the science has gotten to an overwhelming point. But the thing that I would urge committee members to remember about utilities and utility planning is we will build electric generating resource to keep the lights on, and then we'll spread the costs out over 20 or 30 years. And so we make very long-term decisions. And for our customers, that's fine as long as that doesn't result in sudden unexpected changes in prices, because we know that that's very difficult for them to deal with. Our polling numbers are the same as Northwest Natural's. We pretty much share the same service territory. 83% of our customers think this is a problem, a serious problem. We need to do something about it. 73% think we need to take some action. So it pretty much mirrors what Gary was telling you earlier. As a result of our position on the generally on the need for carbon regulation, we've gone back to Washington, D.C., and we're We are lobbying Congress directly and the Oregon delegation specifically for federal cap and trade legislation. I don't need to get into that. I would like to comment on the bills that we've got here today. I think the 3543, the integration bill, is a good idea. I think it sounds like from that a number of our customers have had some good discussions with the governor's office and the other stakeholders, members of this committee, to try to get that bill in a shape that actually will provide some useful information, clearinghouse for the science, and some of the policy analysis that we can all, one place we can all go to discuss these issues and get on the same page. In terms of state cap and trade, I think you heard just a second ago, we're in favor of federal cap and trade. We don't believe state cap and trade makes much sense. You need trading partners, and in Oregon there aren't that many, especially if you're just doing it on utilities. We do believe it should be a broad, multi-sector effort, and not just on utilities, but also on automobiles and the mobile sector. So we don't believe it's time for 3545 right now in Oregon. I think our general principle is national is best, regional is better and workable, but just single state only is real difficult to implement on the cap and trade model. Finally, on emissions performance standard, I think our position on this bill this year is we'd like to have a little more time to study this bill, to work with our stakeholders and customers to figure out how it's going to impact our portfolio. I think a number of these committees may recall I testified in favor of Senate Bill 838 a few weeks ago. It was just last week or earlier this week.
It's all a blur now,
Madam Chair.
I'm in the session.
All a blur. But that's going to require us to make some pretty big decisions about our portfolio of power resources. And I think we just need a little bit of time to understand that and figure out what an emissions performance standard would do and how that would affect our decisions. So we're more than willing to continue the discussions on that. We think it's possible. It could be workable. We just really haven't had the time to sit down with folks and figure that out at this point in the session. So thank you.
Thank you. Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association, a 51-year-old trade association working on a regional basis in Oregon, Washington, Idaho. I'm here today to say something refreshing, and that the pulp and paper industry and forest products is part of the solution to climate change. And sure, bang that gavel now. We believe this because we use biomass for energy generation. We sequester carbon in our forests, and we have the potential to develop biofuels in conjunction with our large manufacturing plants that are nearby our refineries here in the Northwest. Now, I haven't heard anyone come up here and say we're part of the solution yet. And I think that that's a key point for you to consider. And in the process of trying to figure out how to be part of the solution, I'd like to take it down to an on-the-ground example of a business case of how the combination of the legislation you have before you today would affect a recycled newsprint mill in Yamhill County employing 300 family wage jobs. Now, this facility is currently off the grid. They have a natural gas cogen facility, two turbines that can generate 92 megawatts if they're running full capacity and the ability to do biomass for 40 megawatts. Now, the biomass that fuel that they burn in there includes hog fuel if they can find it, which unfortunately is in short supply. They also burn urban wood waste. They burn other waste, but they part of this, their urban wood waste, is creosote-treated wood. They also build agricultural-derived waste, which includes things like filbert shells. Now, not everyone... houses in the urban area have filbert shells that they burn, but everyone does have a certain amount of wood waste that they put in the waste stream. If you were to follow the trucks and the wood waste around the Portland area, you would find a good number of them going to the SP newsprint mill to the boilers. And in Senate Bill 838A, the definition of
biomass, the exclusion would kick out creosote-treated wood. Now, we have had issues with the biomass definition, and you've heard us talk about these, but I want to bring specifically down to who's burning what in a boiler now that currently meets the best of the best control technology in the country. Our boilers are large, therefore they are subject to control under the Clean Air Act's Boiler MACT, Maximum Achievable Control Technology, which is a top 20% control performance across the country. And we do this by controlling the mixture of things that we put in our boilers, whether it be biomass of wood or biomass of other things or that. Now, if you... as we try to be part of the solution to climate change, and we are burning wood-based biomass and other things, if you exclude us from get this particular mill from getting credits for biomass in 838, and in 3545, because they are a self-generator and they would be included in the cap-and-trade program, and you say you're included in cap-and-trade, you're off the grid, so they're included just like a generating utility would be because of the 92-megawatt size of their plant, what you do is you create a situation where in a state-only cap-and-trade program that they would be disadvantaged because they would be treated like the utilities. We have the ability to get biomass to do renewable energy credits, but if you exclude our ability to do that, even though when we are burning the biomass, we meet the best control technology in the country that was recently instituted. By the way, Boiler MACT goes into effect in October of 2007, but we are already meeting those standards because we have to run our source performance tests in the boiler and on our stacks now. So we're already doing this. So I would ask you, as you go forward, to look at the synergistic effects of the legislation that you are thinking about on facilities that believe that they can be part of your solution to climate change in this state, and work a little bit longer on things like state-only cap and trade, and think about exclusions and definitions of biomass that would allow us to be counted as part of the solution instead of penalized for being early actors while we provide family wage jobs in this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Thank you very much. And colleagues, I am going to recess these public hearings for a moment. We have somebody who would very much like to testify on the last bill that we have up, and she cannot stay for the remainder of the hearing. So she really wants to get her comments on the record. I said I'd give her 2 minutes. So do I need to gavel out, or can we?
No, yeah, just... close the public hearing.
Okay,
I'm
going to recess the public hearings on House Bill 3543, House Bill 2859, House Bill 3545, and then I'm going to open up a hearing on House Bill 2566, which is the groundwater exemption bill. The dash twos completely replaced the bill, so we're hearing testimony only on the dash twos, but I appreciate, I know you have to leave, so if you'd like to come up, state your name, your comments on the record, and then we'll close public hearing and continue with the other public hearings.
Thank you very much. I didn't expect special treatment. My name is, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sarah Doimling. I live in the Groundwater Limited area of the Eola Hills in Polk County. We heard about this a little bit late, but quite separate from the bill. The citizens of our particular Groundwater Limited area have drawn up a petition in light of additional development and water shortages, and I will just briefly read the cover letter and then hand in the petition with the examples. Protection of water is a critical issue increasing in importance as population continues to rise. With the passage of ballot measure 37, development in many rural areas has been proposed with the majority of water needs met by exempt wells. The attached position is from a group of 93 landowners and water right holders from the Eola Hills west of Salem, a groundwater limited area. This petition, which was submitted to the Water Resources Commission, requests a moratorium on domestic well drilling in the Eola Hills groundwater limited area until an inventory of the resource is completed and an adequate plan is in place for conservation of the remaining water, which includes protection of existing water rights. The petition stems from concern regarding both groundwater and surface water in at least three hydrologically connected basins fed from the Eola Hills. Our primary concern with current law is that it allows domestic wells to be drilled using up to 15,000 gallons a day with no permitting process to manage or regulate usage. Current water right holders with both wells and surface water rights are severely impacted by as few as one additional exempt well. There are already state statutes and administrative rules which provide language to protect groundwater in designated critical and limited areas, requiring inventories to be taken and conservation plans developed prior to any additional water use. But as our group has observed, that language is often ignored by county commissioners and planning departments. To us, this creates serious liability issues for both the counties and state agencies responsible for protection of the water resources. When exempt wells are drilled, there is no process to ensure that there will not be interference with previous water right holders. The impact of a new exempt well on surrounding wells is obvious, but what is often overlooked is the surface water impacts. In the Eola Hills, many springs exist that feed streams in three water basins. Our petitioners include landowners that live along these streams and some with water rights dating back to the 1890s. And all agree that the stream flows have diminished significantly due to the cumulative effect of increased development, including exempt well drilling in the hills above. We are concerned, particularly in our area, that additional development, including several multiple dwelling developments proposed under ballot measure 37, will continue to diminish the existing aquifer to a point where it will render existing wells and surface water rights useless. And we have 93 signatures, and we have more coming in all the time. So it's an ongoing process. And I just like to say that as opposed to Measure 37, which has been so divisive, this seems to have crossed all boundaries. And we've had unanimous approval of the petition. So I will submit the rest, and thank you very much.
Thank you for coming. We appreciate it. And I want to see if the committee just had any questions, since I know you have to leave. Okay. Thank you. And if you can submit that testimony. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing, House Bill 2566, which we will reopen as soon as we're done with these public hearings. And then I guess we were in recess for House Bill 3543, 2859, and 3545, so we're no longer in recess. And I will call up the remainder of the witnesses. Michael Early. Is Michael here? Michael Early, Jim Stelson, and Wayne Estes. Okay, Michael, you can get started, and you have 2 minutes right now.
Thank you. This is Michael Early, and the Executive Director of Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. With regard to the integration bill, as other parties have indicated, we have had some very productive meetings with the governor's staff on this. We think we're moving toward a bill that we can support. Our focus, of course, is upon making sure that as we move toward implementation to reach these goals, that it doesn't disadvantage Oregon businesses as compared to similar businesses in other states in which Oregon participates in a joint cap and trade sort of mechanism. With that said, we haven't seen final language. We're still working on that. The governor's staff is still working on that. So it is positive, but we'll reserve judgment until we see the final language. Secondly, on the performance emission standards bill, which I just saw today, 2 points. One, I think there's some problems with the language of the bill. The long-term commitment definition just talks about investments in baseload generation. It doesn't talk about an exception for upgrades. So, for example, if the utility had to make an additional investment, even in an environmental upgrade, it could trigger the baseload requirement, which it may not be able to meet because the grandfathering only extends to existing combustion turbines. So I think there's a variety of language issues there that need to be addressed. But broader, I think it might be a little short-sighted. Remember, global warming is global by its nature, and if Oregon walks away and doesn't allow its utilities to invest money into new technologies other than renewables, it's sort of incumbent upon us to develop those technologies, not just for Oregon, but for the whole world. And the reality is coal is going to be used in a variety of places around the world, and it's important that technology be developed, and I think it's important that we not walk away from that. Thirdly, on cap and trade, frankly, we think it's premature that cap and trade is, in order for it to work, it needs to be broader than just one state. Like the utilities you heard from earlier, we believe that cap and trade is best handled at the national level. Thank you.
Okay, great, thank you. And state your name for the record, please.
Madam Chairman, I'm Jim Stelson from Douglas County, Roseburg. I'm a board member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. I'm also an energy engineer, and have done energy management in hospitals for my entire career. I'm here to support all of these bills, particularly 3545. I think it has the most detail and gets more into the actual items that are going to make a difference in the long term. I wanted to share some numbers. There's the awareness on global warming continues to be broader and broader, but we need to get past the discussion stages, and I wanted to share these numbers. Kyoto Protocol, which was initiated in the late 1990s, set goals for developed countries to get 10% below 1990 levels of carbon dioxide emissions. Well, in 1990, according to the Energy Information Administration, global energy use was 84 plus quadrillion BTU. By 2004, which is the last year I have numbers, it was at 100 quadrillion BTU, an increase of 18.6%. And if that 1.3% per year were just continue to the year 2020, we'd be at 47% higher than what 1990 was. So we'd be looking at a 57% decrease to get to that level. So Kyoto, as we've studied the problem, we've had conversations, the goal gets farther and farther away. So it is time to try something bold, to be a leader, and make some mistakes if necessary, and to learn from it.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. I know you came from over 100 miles, so we appreciate that.
Madam Chairman, my name is Wayne Estes. I am also from Douglas County. I live in Oakland, Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Douglas County Global Warming Coalition. And I just want to express my strong support for all three bills, in particular the 3543 and the 2859. Regarding the cap and trade bill, I do agree with several of the other people who feel that it would be most effective and useful if it covered the largest possible geographic area and covered all carbon-emitting industries and not just single-out utilities or some group of those industries. But for the House Bill 3543, I want to express strong support for creation of the Global Warming Coalition Commission to coordinate the state's activities, and that the Global Warming Commission and the Climate Research Institute would help the lawmakers, state agencies, and Oregon companies to make truly informed decisions about global warming and help the state of Oregon and Oregon companies to become a leader in that field. Because as other people stated, I believe this is something that Oregon can be, leadership is to the state's advantage, and to get ahead of the curve and develop the skills and the knowledge and the processes to reduce global warming pollution. And we can then be a leader and basically export that knowledge and skills to the rest of the world. And I feel that we really have a moral imperative to coordinate and act intelligently in this, because we had the information, we see the crisis coming, and we have a moral duty to reduce the burden of the changing climate on future generations. And regarding the emission performance standard, I just want to state my support for that as well, and I think it's very important to count or measure electricity that Oregon consumes that is generated out of state. We need to look at what we consume regardless of where it comes from.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And we also have somebody else from Douglas County, Stuart Leibowitz.
We're leaving written test.
Okay, so we'll take him off. And then there's North Cheatham. And I will also call up John Etzel. John Etzel and Frank Young. Welcome. We'll start on the side and we'll work our way over.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is North Cheatham. I'm representing Northwest Sustainable Energy. Northwest Sustainable Energy, based in Seattle, implements and coordinates grant and contract-given contracts throughout the Northwest, and I serve as their vice chair, and I live in Hood River. Our neighboring state legislatures to the north and south have both recently passed similar bills addressing power plant performance standards regarding the allowable greenhouse gas emissions from baseload electrical generation. This is an essential step in combating climate change, because power generation is a major statewide contributor of greenhouse gases. Specifically, I am referring to laws which prevent long-term investments in power plants with greenhouse gas emissions in excess of those produced by a combined cycle natural gas power plant. For all practical purposes, this bill would effectively eliminate new coal-burning plants from coming online in Oregon, because the only way they could meet or exceed this standard would be if sequestering CO2, that is, injecting this product of coal combustion into ground cavities, could be made economically feasible. Coal-burning power plants presently emit more than twice the CO2 per megawatt hour produced than natural gas plants. As many of you are aware, there are numerous incentives already in place to encourage the development of clean, decentralized, renewable energy. Accelerated depreciation, federal production tax credits, access to low-interest financing, and Oregon's business energy tax credit. These have certainly increased the attractiveness of alternative power sources, but the fact is we still have a long way to go, as only 3% of our current power consumption is derived from renewable sources other than hydro. The most significant remaining barrier to increasing this percentage is that coal-fired plants have traditionally been the cheapest source of new baseload electrical generation. In the Mid-Columbia region where I live, it is impossible to miss the impact of wind energy development due to the frequency of turbine trucks traveling east on I-84. Projects now under construction in Oregon and Washington will add 2,600 megawatts of capacity by 2011. Mid-Columbia Community College estimates that 365 wind turbine technician jobs will be created by this construction, and is struggling to implement an academic program for training individuals to fill those jobs. Northwest Sustainable Energy encourages this trend not only because of its contribution to clean, reliable energy, but also because of the high-quality, family-wage jobs it creates for our sparsely populated and economically depressed backcountry. Passage of HB 2859, we feel, would not only significantly reduce the total greenhouse gases our state emits, but will also stimulate rural economies wherever renewable power sources and available transmission capacity exists.
Thank you. didn't know if you were John or Frank, so.
Committee.
And if you could state your name for the record, please, so folks
listening. My name is John Etzel.
Thank you, John.
I live in Portland, but my property is in rural Clackamas County. I would like to live there, but I'm not allowed to build a house, so I filed under Measure 37. I would also like to drill a well. I believe I'm allowed to now, but they're going to put a bill in here now to hold that to permit, but not permit that. I had a dug well, hand dug well. I closed in about 8 years ago because of the danger of someone may fall into it. I just I have a small grove of trees there. I cut my own firewood. It's cut and seasoned for a year outside. It's put under a roof then. So the emission is very low on that. And I just hope I'll be able to get a permit. I'd like to build one house only. That's all I need. And it's all in, practically all mule trees, so that's putting a lot of oxygen into the air. So I'm small potatoes, but I don't, I'm just an individual. But that's my feeling on it now.
Okay. And sir, were you, I just wanted to make sure, you knew this is, the hearings we're having are on the climate change bills, and so I think you may have signed up on the wrong sheet, maybe. We're signing up for the groundwater.
Oh, maybe.
Okay,
yes.
So just for the record, I will note that his testimony was for House Bill 2566.
Okay.
And did you have, were you testifying on that bill as well?
Hi, we're going to put a little humor in here right now. I'm Friendly Frank. I'll always be young, Frank Young. And I really come to testify on something else, but I think a lot of these rules are going to make a lot of hardships on us, but when I think about global warming and what it's going to do to us, it was interesting. I heard on the radio the other night that the scientists are talking about there will be big super things from the sun coming, making it super hot around the year 2012, and the Mayan calendar that was put out probably thousands of years ago ends in 2012, and it kind of acts like we'll still be here, but not maybe all of us. Thank you.
All right, thank you, and I like your hat. My dad would like that hat.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I just want to tell the two gentlemen that thank you so much for coming down to the Capitol. You're a breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I've been out working, so you have to pardon the clothes.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, we have a few more folks that would like to testify on the climate change bills, and that is Gary Granunke. See if I'm saying that right, and I apologize if I'm not. Jim Edelson and Fred Hewitt. Thank you for coming, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Okay, I'm Gary Granunke. I'm a research scientist at a large semiconductor firm in the state, but that's my day job. And my night job is I'm the co-chairman of the Oregon Electric Vehicle Association, which is more related to why I'm here. So we have a very unique perspective, and we see things that most people don't see because we build electric vehicles. And people, when we are considering electric power generation, we'd like you to do something that might seem paradoxically making things worse. We'd like you to promote the use of electricity rather than simple conservation in the transportation sector. Why is that? Because electric cars basically are about four times more efficient than gasoline cars and even three times more efficient than biodiesel or any kind of diesel, really. So those of us that drive electric cars or plug-in hybrid electric cars, we're getting 200 miles per gallon energy equivalent. With just 3 kilowatts on my roof, I can go 100 miles a day. So we're all into renewable. Some of us are into renewable energy as well. So we think that we have some good news when it comes to global warming, that we know how to at least do some of the things. We can work on transportation. I think agriculture is going to be a big problem, more so than transportation. So there's a picture there on plug-in hybrids. And plug-in hybrids, today we have about 24 people that have hacked their Priuses to put in bigger battery packs and be able to plug them in at night. So this gives them about 150 miles per gallon until the batteries run down, and then they become a normal Prius. But most people don't drive 50 miles a day in their car. So the result is that we can produce a zero-emissions vehicle that uses far less energy for most of our daily commuting. Down in Austin, they put up a bunch of big wind farms, and in fact, their program is already fully subscribed, and they're building more power lines out to them. But what they decided was there was a big problem in their payback on building these wind farms, and that is the wind blows at night, and there's no place to store the electricity. So they decided that they would put together, having a public utility, a policy to promote the use of plug-in hybrid vehicles that can charge at night, and that reduces their air pollution, it reduces their energy dependence. They're from the oil patch, and they know what's happening with oil. Okay, so that references pluginpartners.org. Okay, so I guess in summary, electric generation capacity for transportation does help reduce CO2 emissions in the transportation sector, which you're not thinking about now, but since you're thinking about electric generation, it's relevant. By plugging in at night, we can increase the payback for renewable power. I do sign up for PGE does offer the new wind farm. You can subscribe to wind farm, which a lot of us do. And finally, using renewable electric power, adding more renewable power rather than simply alternative fossil fuels, definitely can give you a bonus when it comes to reducing CO2 emissions as well as other emissions. So we think that you should accelerate your efforts to encourage the development of renewable power in the state so that we can actually use them in the transportation sector. And who knows, GM may even do a good job with building the Volt for us. Thank you.
Quick question is, when will the plug-in hybrids be commercially viable?
Toyota has said they are doing it. They're actually in one of the leaders in this area. They did not give a time when they would be in production. We think they can do it very easily since 24 of us amateurs have done it for them and have excellent results. GM is building the Volt. Daimler Chrysler is experimenting with the Sprinter vans that are plug-in hybrids. And so there's a lot of things happening that I can't even keep track of myself. There's a two-day conference next, the 14th and 15th of May in Wenatchee on this topic. So there's a lot going on. So across the political spectrum, even the national security folks like James Woolsey and Plug-in America is endorsing plug-in hybrids, as well as the environmental folks you would expect.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Fred Hewitt with the Sierra Club. We have about 1.3 million members and supporters around the country, and it's no surprise we strongly support the three bills before you today. I want to step back and talk a little bit about the bigger dilemma that we're facing here. The keystone of the whole question of climate change is uncertainty. Scientists tell us that the atmosphere, what we've already put in the atmosphere, is going to cause pretty significant change, but we don't know how much and we don't know where. I think we have a pretty good idea that the polar areas, for example, high mountain areas, glaciers, and so forth, will have effects already observed, and those will increase in the future. We don't really know how fast we here in Oregon will be affected and what the impacts will be. Secretary of State Bradbury gave a good presentation here the other night talking about some of those issues. In looking at the three bills before you today, I note that when he was Senator Bill Bradbury, he was the chair of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee in 1989, and that legislature passed a bill sponsored by his committee, Senate Bill 576, which created the first, perhaps the second global warming study by the state of Oregon. The first one was actually an Oregon Governor's Task Force report that came out in 1990, but which I have here. The second, under the State Energy Plan, came out as a result of Senate Bill 576. There are excerpts from that in the back of the testimony that I prepared. What's interesting in looking back at that first round of planning is that the concerns were pretty much the same as we have today, although we obviously have a lot more information about what's going on. And the agenda at that point was to look at changes that would reduce greenhouse gases by 20% below 1988 levels by 2005. And when you look at some of the recommendations, they're really they're ambitious in some ways but modest in others. Cleaner cars, reduce the use of coal plants, build more energy-efficient mass transit, and so forth. Those same agenda items, we've addressed some, and we have a lot more to do. But in looking at the complexity of this issue, the dilemma is really, how do we deal with the uncertainty? It's a very difficult process to understand and to figure out what tasks we should take on. The tendency, I think, in many of our institutions is to try to find the most perfect approach, implement it, and say, make it so. This is probably not the kind of problem that lends itself to that. Maybe most problems don't. But it turns out we also have in Oregon real practical experience with a different kind of approach called adaptive management, which is actually pretty widespread throughout our agencies, institutions, for dealing with restoration and management of natural systems. And, of course, the climate is one of the biggest ones we have. I've attached to my testimony a brief definition of adaptive management. Basically, the interesting thing about adaptive management is it's as much of anything as not really techniques, it's a philosophy. It's a way of thinking about how to address the problem. And adaptive management takes the approach of a combination of learning and experience. By experience meaning put out programs, cap and trade, carbon taxes, what have you, regulation programs, control programs, education. The learning part is figuring out what works and how to implement it so that it gets us where we need to go. So I really would recommend thinking of this not in terms of doom and gloom or something that we can't handle, but this is really, it's a very serious problem that we're facing here, no question about it. But I believe that in our state we actually have the basis, the ability to free up the creativity and innovation that we have within ourselves through a process of adaptive management, and I hope that this committee will consider that and that this process will go forward on that basis. Thank you.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Jim Edelson. I serve on the advisory councils of the Oregon Interfaith Power and Light and the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign. And we support, as you've heard, all three bills. I just want to talk a little bit today, a bit more about HB 2859. What I'd like to say is that if you do not pass HB 3545, it is absolutely essential that you do pass out HB 2859, the Emission Performance Standards. I represented the Interfaith Campaign on Governor Kulongowski's Carbon Allocation Task Force, and I want to let you know that the need for early action was a big topic in analyzing the issues before the task force, because if you do not take early action, the ability of a cap-and-trade system to achieve the governor's goals or the state's goals later on becomes much more difficult. I would like to enter into the record a letter from on January 10th from the chair of the task force plus eight other members of the task force explaining our reasons for the need for the emissions performance standard to be passed in the 2007 legislature regardless of what happened to the cap and trade bill. And those reasons are all set forth in that letter signed by all of us to the governor. I want to just summarize my comments by saying that 92% of the electric customers on the West Coast are now covered and protected by an emissions performance standard. The only 8% of electric customers on the West Coast not protected by an emissions performance standard all live in Oregon. These customers will be liable for the costs and the risks associated with new coal-fired power plants. I think it is essential that we pass an emissions performance standard immediately, regardless of what happens to the cap and trade standard immediately, because if we want to solve the problem, the first thing we need to do is not dig ourselves deeper into the carbon hole, and that is exactly the intention of HB 2859. And some of the language can be worked on. There's some great model for that in the Washington 6001 legislation. But it is a piece of legislation that is essential that not next legislature, but that this legislature pass. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any quick questions for the panel? Representative Smith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Both of you mentioned coal fire plants. Do you know, how many coal fire plants do we have in the state of Oregon?
No. Well, we have one major operating coal-fired power plant in Boardman.
In Morrow County? Follow-up?
Right. But 41, about 40% of our electricity consumed by ratepayers in Oregon is generated by coal-fired power.
Have you ever seen that?
Follow-up?
That facility?
Yes, I have. Yes.
Do you realize it represents about 25% of the tax base of Morrow County, which pays for schools, public service, libraries, hospitals?
No, I did not realize that, but I'm not surprised.
Representative Smith, we have a lot of people waiting to testify.
This isn't my district. I want to ask the question. I've stayed quiet for an hour and a half. What would you propose to the citizens of Morrow County to make up that 25%?
Representative Smith, we are not proposing, and the emissions performance standard does not in any way address existing plants as of June 1st, 2008.
It's for new plants, that's my understanding.
New plants and new contracts for new power, which are primarily being proposed for the states of Utah and Colorado and Montana to serve Oregon load.
Thank you.
I guess it's a parting shot. It's not a comment. It's a shot, and I throw this to the three of you gentlemen. I guess I'm concerned that if I went out and purchased a CO2-reducing electric hybrid, it wouldn't be able to pull my trailer with my six ATVs.
Well, sir, we've done Humvees as well.
PEI in Atlanta, in Huntsville, did a Humvee, and it has 20-mile electric range with no heat signature and goes up steeper grades. Most of the hybrids that are not the Prius and the Civic are actually, people are adding electric hybrids not to reduce emissions or gas mileage, but to give more power. And, in fact, we do have more power. So if you go to plasmaboyracing.com, you can see John with his old Datsun beating a new bet by a second and a quarter mile PIR.
Thank you for your thought.
Okay, thank you. We'll make sure we all check out that website. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. And we have one last person I'd like to testify, Ted Lawrenson from the Department of Forestry, and then we will move on to our last public hearing. I haven't looked at that site recently, but maybe we should all take a look at it.
It would get to Salem faster.
Well, there's always the state police that are out there patrolling.
Hey. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I am here to testify in support of House Bill 3543. Many of you may not be familiar with the Board of Forestry's strategic plan called the Forestry Partnership for Oregon, but it does have in it, as one of the seven key strategies for sustainable management of Oregon's forests, that a need to establish programs to enhance carbon storage in forests and Oregon's forest products as one of those strategies. Very clearly, Oregon's a forest-rich state, and our forests are both Oregon's lungs and the world's lungs, and they take in carbon and deliver oxygen in that process. They can store carbon. Having more forest cover is a positive force. Reducing forest cover is a negative force, and indeed that's a source of emissions you need to think about. Oregon has one of the highest per acre potentials for carbon sequestration and storage in the world in terms of its forests. And there's a number of forest management techniques that both can sequester carbon and reduce emissions. And I won't go through those, but I will, again, emphasize the need to keep forests in forest use. And nationally, the country's losing 1 million acres of forest land a year, which is expected to occur over the next 50 years at that rate, Oregon is now just seeing a trend that is starting to mimic what's being seen elsewhere in the country along those lines. Within the context of trying to make the bill a little bit stronger with regard to the role of forest in carbon sequestration and mitigating global climate change, we recommend a number of things. Particularly in Section 1, we think a finding needs to be added that forested areas of Oregon and across the planet do play a major role in sequestration, and the consequence of losing this sequestration potential would have a significant effect on the ability to reduce carbon levels and achieve the goals of the bill. So we think the bill ought to specifically recognize the importance of forest lands. Third, I guess in terms of another specific recommendation, we suggest that the Global Warming Commission specifically monitor and analyze the role and potential of Oregon's forests in terms of carbon sequestration and ways of increasing that potential, and that the bill specifically direct the Global Warming Commission to work with the Department of Forestry and OSU College of Forestry in that process and look at the rates and carbon storage of Oregon's forests, analyze alternative forest management practices, and reduce opportunities that might be changed through wildfire and tree species distribution that might result from global warming. We think this is an important step. We encourage you to recognize the important role that forests can play. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, Ted. Any questions? Representative Early.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ted, thank you very much for coming today, because, and colleagues, I want to really encourage that we take a hard look at these recommendations, because one of the things that I've been doing recently with Society of American Foresters and other publications, in fact, I've been talking to Congressman Walden's office because he's very involved in this too, is, you know, the role that forestry can play in something like this is still not quite clear yet, and I think that these amendments for this commission would be very, very helpful to try and get some good science and how this can be effective and play a role in this thing. So I would encourage us to really take a look at these amendments and see if we can get them in the bill.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Ted, for bringing these forward.
Madam Chairman, I had 33 and a half seconds left, and there was some testimony here I'd like to add to that might be very important where we want.
Okay, we'll start the clock right now for the 33 and a half seconds.
Okay, in regards to the hybrid.
Could you just state your name again?
Franklin Young. And in regards to the hybrid, Toyota in particular, but it would probably apply to the other ones that are battery operated mostly. But I just read an article 3 weeks ago in the Oregonian, which may or may not be true, but it's certainly worth consideration, that the hybrids actually, by the time they mine the nickel up in Canada and ship it somewhere else and then ship it to Japan, and the mines up there in Canada completely devoid the vegetation for miles around. Our space scientists, or space aces, what do we call them? Astronauts. They go up there to train on it like it's on the moon or something, because there's nothing there. And so they compared it to a Hummer, to the Toyota hybrid. And the hybrid, by the time it got all done worldwide, makes about three times more pollution than a Hummer. So.
Thank you for sharing that, and I'm sure the Oregonian appreciates the pitch. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3543, the public hearing on House Bill 2859, and the public hearing on House Bill 3545. I will now open up a public hearing on House Bill 2566. And committee members, you should have, actually, we're getting a new committee member, a new committee administrator up here, Beth Petrino, who's going to give.
She's up enough on me.
We're voting one of the people off the island.
The last one. I'm sorry.
My last joke went over the line.
That was it.
Getting a new committee administrator who is going to provide an overview of the amendment, and you should have the dash twos at your at the dais. Do you have the dash twos in front of you? I'm sure everyone got copies. Okay, we'll make sure that everybody gets a copy of the dash twos.
Ian?
Does everyone have copies of the dash twos?
You should in your packet.
I'm not seeing any nodding up here, so.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I'm sorry, which one is it?
2516.
I'm just making sure that my committee members are awake. Beth will give an overview of the Dash 2s, and then we were going to have, are we going to have the department come up, or we'll have them come up at the end? Okay. Okay.
Can I pass on some?
Thank you, Beth.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just distributed to each of you a preliminary staff measure summary which describes the Dash 2 amendments under the effect of committee amendment section, so I'll just go over that briefly. In Section 1 of the Dash 2 amendments, there are a number of changes. First of all, the proposed amendments lowers the volume allowance for exempt groundwater uses for a single domestic use from the current 15,000 gallons per day to 5,000 gallons per day. And under the amendments, that would include the watering of one-half acre of lawn or non-commercial garden. It also would include that one-half acre of lawn or non-commercial garden watering per well or water system under the volume limitation for group domestic, which stays where it is currently at 5,000 gallons per day, and single industrial or commercial purpose, which stays again where it is today at 15,000 gallons per day. The amendments define water system, and again in Section 1, they also authorize the Water Resources Department to collect a $250 fee for recording the use of certain exempt groundwater uses, including single domestic, group domestic, and single industrial or commercial. The language directs the funds to be used to conduct groundwater studies, groundwater monitoring, and the implementation of a later section, Section 4A below, which authorizes the department to require permit applications for groundwater after an area is designated as a groundwater limited area or a critical groundwater area. It requires the department to adopt rules to implement that permitting provision. Section 2 of the amendment specifies that these amendments apply prospectively, so to groundwater that is used following the effective date of this act, and also specifies that that permitting authority is also prospective. Sections 3 and 4 are conforming amendments. Section 5 simply explains the captions that are part of the amendments. I also have a visual that the department prepared that I think is helpful in terms of understanding the difference between current law and what the Dash 2 amendments would cause.
Thank you, Beth. You done?
Yep.
I'm done. There you go. Pass it, please. And I just want to make sure for the folks in the audience, before we start, and we have a couple pages of testimony, I think we'll be able to get through it all if folks keep their comments to 2 minutes. And we have a few members that can stay afterwards. We do have this room a little bit later, but I will be beginning to lose members at 3 o'clock. I want to just make a note for the record that because of time, we will be holding the work session on Senate Bill 838 over to Monday because we have both a day session and an evening session scheduled for Monday. We will work through until midnight if we need to finish all our bills. Hopefully we won't need to bring our bedrolls, but you never know. I also just want to mention that the Dash 2s in front of you completely replace the bill that we're hearing, House Bill 2566. So that's what's known as the gut and stuff. It sounds like a not very nice type of maneuver, but what it means is that the original bill is no longer what we're hearing testimony on, but the Dash 2 amendments. There should be copies in the back of the room of the Dash 2 amendments if folks are signed up would like to.
Any okay.
Yes. Our committee administrator says that there are, so hopefully there are. Okay, with that, I will start calling up some folks. We have, let's see, Peggy Lynch, George Gerspach, and I apologize if I'm not saying your name right, and Tom Quintal.
I've been known as Peggy Lynch, so that's pretty good.
I did say Peggy Lynch, didn't I?
No, you said Lynch. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peggy Lynch. Representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We have long been concerned about Oregon's water, both surface and groundwater. And in 1976, the League published 2 studies on water. We also want to point out that ORS 536.310 declares as policy, and I'll just slip to the last 2 lines, the principle that all of the waters within this state belong to the public for the use by the people for beneficial purposes without waste. I also want to mention that this letter relates to the Dash 1s, but as I quickly scanned the Dash 2s, there We very cleverly didn't get into gallons in our testimony, so I suspect that this letter applies to the dash twos as well. It is because of this principle that it is the public's water, that the league supports the compromise embedded in the dash ones, and I think probably the dash twos are just fine as well. The amendments recognize that new domestic wells for minimum household usage should be recorded with the Water Resources Department, but not required to file a permit yet. The minimum fee required on recording of this using protects groundwater users as it provides a degree of funding for the Resources Department to investigate groundwater disputes. And there's also recognition in the amendments that critical groundwater areas exist in Oregon and more may be designated. Those areas are of special concern to all Oregonians, so requiring a permit for groundwater usage in those areas allows for greater oversight there. Thank you for considering our comments, and we encourage you to move this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. I don't want to say your name wrong again, so.
Gerschbacher. Excuse me just a second.
Is it a visual aid?
Sir, I'll hold it for you.
Just a permit.
Yes, there was a charge for those who couldn't hear in the back for holding the visual. For the record, can you please state your name?
Madam Chairman, my name is George Gerschbacher. My wife and I reside at 7495 Anderson Road, Southeast Almsville. We live in the heart of the State and Sublimity Almsville Sensitive Groundwater Area, and the border is that area there. Well, you see the three towns are in green, but what color are they? Red? I don't know. I guess it's red. Those are actually Measure 37 claims. I'm a realtor by profession and have been since 1970, and I'm strongly in favor of the bill, at least most of the bill. According to Merritt County Planning Commission, there's 41,800 acres in that sensitive groundwater area. And as of about a month or a month and a half ago, there had been 39 Measure 37 claims filed in that area, which amounted to just around 5,500 acres, which could be broken up into two-acre sites. Currently, no irrigation wells are allowed in that area, but as we all know, domestic wells are unrestricted throughout any area in Oregon. I was born and raised on the 35 acres that we live on there, and my family has owned it since 1913. In 1962, the Water Resources Department started monitoring our well on a regular basis, first monthly for many years, then quarterly, and then finally on an annual basis. And this continued until 1992. For approximately 30 years. During that period of time, our water table dropped 18 feet. And in your packet, you have a complete dialogue of that well and what took place during those years that they monitored. I was told by the Water Resources Department at that time, and then recently dropped it just because of lack of funding. From 1968 through approximately 1985, there had been five small-acre rural subdivisions created in that area to the west and south of where we live. This amounted to a total of about 400 acres. And I can say, I think, that drop in water table probably had a direct result of that increased use of water in that area. With a number of Measure 37 claims filed in this area, I propose the following. One, restrict development of any type in sensitive groundwater areas until a hydrological study is made of the availability of water in those areas. Number two, require permitting of any new wells, especially in these areas and preferably throughout the state. Number three, restrict new or existing wells to provide water to no more than two homes. Number four, all applications for domestic irrigation and commercial use of wells should be should not be through the county, but under the jurisdiction of the Water Resources Department. Number five, resume the monitoring of wells throughout the state, especially in sensitive groundwater areas. Number six, I'm not really in favor of metering of any wells at this time. We do not feel that our well water should be jeopardized by new developments of any kind. There is a problem that needs to be addressed now. Every new well must be logged into a system that allows the Water Resources Department to check how many wells are in that area through an application and permit process, which would allow approval or rejection of the permit. This does not place any undue burden or hardship on an applicant. I want to repeat that. Does not place any undue hardship on an applicant. If this had been implemented years ago, we wouldn't have the water problems that we have now. I urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay.
Chair Dinkfelder and members of the committee, my name is Tom Quintel, and I do have a small existing domestic well. And I know this bill doesn't affect me directly right now, but I had some concerns, I think, for future, in that they want to study the aquifers, which I think is a good thing. However, I believe that this $250 fee that they're asking for is going to be shared by a very small percentage of the new wells being drilled. Consequently, I think that's sort of unfair and discriminatory. And I'm curious why they couldn't use the economic aspect of going to the lottery for funds for this, because I think it would have some application. So I think it just needs to have a little more fairness on the fee part of it. And the other thing I'm concerned about is, while in the future, if my area became a water-sensitive area, and, you know, while the bill exempts me now, that doesn't exempt me from this bill being amended into the future by requiring me to pay this additional fee. So I think it's, you know, it's got some issues there that I don't feel are fair, and that's basically all I have to say.
Thank you very much for coming today. Appreciate it.
Okay. Chair?
Question?
Mr. Gerspacher, would you mind coming back up? I'd like to ask you a question, please, sir. Thank you. I was just curious. I mean, these proposals that you have here restricting newer existing wells, et cetera, have you ever made this request of the Water Resources Commission for these things within this area of sensitive water?
Oh, we've talked about it. I have talked to members of the Water Resources Department recently, yes, since this testimony started.
So have you...
I testified over to Water Resources meeting in the end of February, yes.
Okay, so you made a formal request to the commission to do this, and what was their response?
I better qualify myself. Their plan is to start monitoring wells again, yes. They had a number of wells that they were monitoring back at that time, and they were dropped, and they plan on initiating that process again. Of course, it's going to take a year or two before... at least go through one or two seasons to see how much of a drop there is or change in from what the existing levels are. But they are planning on doing that.
Okay, one last question. Did you specifically ask that they require permitting of any new wells or to restrict any new wells in that area?
Yes.
And what do you recall what they said to that?
They were basically taking testimony and never really answered anything. Right,
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Gerspacher. We have a senator in the room, so Senator Whitsitt.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Cannon, committee members. Just a couple of things that I wanted to point out about this particular -2 amendments. The Section 11AD does reduce the amount of usable water from a domestic well by 67%, as I'm sure you know. The $250 fee according to the Oregon Water Resources Department, would raise about $1 million a year in revenue for the department. There's about 3,800 wells a year that would come under that fee. The required permit in a critical groundwater reclassified area under ORS 536.340 actually addresses the highest and best use, so that if the commission were to reclassify the water within a watershed as to the highest and best use of something other than domestic use, then all the wells in that watershed, as I read this, would fall into that under that permitting category. And then lastly, section 11B limits both single and domestic and single industrial use. I'm on the wrong line here. The final thought is that within the Dash 2 amendments, we have a requirement that the wells are I lost my thought process here for a second. The water system as defined in this Dash 2 amendment includes all the wells on a lot or parcel, whether they are connected or not connected. So in the situation where you had, for instance, a owner that has a full section of land and that is under one tax parcel, and that land had, that parcel had, say, three homes on it or four homes on it. By the way I read this Dash 2 amendment, that parcel would be limited to 5,000 gallons of domestic water per day, even though there would might be four disparately located homes on that same parcel. And that is a concern also. And that's all I have today.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you.
Thanks very much. All right. Let's have Jerry Schmidt, Scott Ashcombe, and Harlan up to the witness table. Harlan, maybe? Who I saw. Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Ashcombe with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. I've handed out written testimony, which I'll summarize briefly. The written testimony addresses the Dash 1 amendments to the bill. I'd like you to know that we're also in favor of the Dash 2 amendments of the bill. So we're in support of House Bill 2566 with the Dash 2 amendments or the Dash 1 amendments. There are minor changes between the two. If you'd like to discuss them, I'd be more than happy to do that. But basically, they're the same idea. They leave the existing exemptions in place. They reduce the exemption for single-family exempt domestic wells, homes. To 3,000 gallons a day, and allow the continuation of the 15,000 gallon exemption for a group domestic. The bill, most importantly, and we strongly support this, in fact we proposed this in the work group, was to allow the exemptions to continue. In other words, don't eliminate the exemptions, because if you eliminate the exemptions, then people who have to have domestic water have to go and get a domestic water right from the Water Resource Department, and that at an estimated 3,800 domestic exemptions applied for a year in the state of Oregon, that would really seriously increase the workload of the Water Resource Department. So we what we did was to allow the exemptions to continue and to put a $250 recording fee on the exempt uses to basically contribute to the water rights fund in the Water Resource Department right now to do groundwater monitoring, groundwater research, so that we can determine whether or not these, what we consider to be really de minimis uses of water, are in fact de minimis in groundwater limited areas or critical groundwater areas. So we think that that the committee has an opportunity to actually do some significant good here, and we support the bill. Thank you very much.
Jerry? Sorry, I was out in the room for a minute.
Didn't even realize you were here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, for the record,
I have that effect on people, I guess.
I was looking at my notes. For the record, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association, and we oppose the bill. And basically, our opposition is that it's a fairness issue, and we feel that this kind of drives a stake between the urban and rural user. If, in fact, you're going to ask that water use in Oregon ought to be for beneficial use without waste, it ought to apply equally to an urban user as well as a rural user. So establishing a limit on a rural user without establishing a unit on an urban user is discriminatory. The issue of requiring a $250 fee for a rural user, people who pull a start card pay $125. The $125 covers well inspections. It covers the department's cost for personnel. It also partly funds a department hydrogeologist. It also funds administrative costs. So with that, we already pay as a rural user those fees to help augment the department's expenses. It, of course, in addition, the rural user will pay the fees of the well development, the apertures, the pumps, the well house, the sundry cost. It's not unusual for an exempt user to have about $20,000 invested. Then for maintenance, of course, they have the maintenance cost, and they also have the electric bill and whatever. But I guess my point, getting back here, is trying to be fair. If, in fact, the exempt user is using only 1% of the state's water, then why are they paying the fee to do groundwater research if, in fact, they're only using 1% of the state's water?
So, Gary, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up. Because
okay, I'm... I'll do it real quick.
Okay,
I oppose the bill. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Levy.
We're just running out of time. I'm losing members.
I understand, and there are the other people who want to say something.
Okay, Harlan.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We, too, are opposed to the bill before you, House Bill 2566 and the Dash 2 amendments. I do want to state we are very appreciative of the chair's willingness to hear our concerns and our appointment to the work group that dealt with this bill. Specifically with respect to the Dash 2s, they are an improvement over the original bill, but we still cannot support them because they are assuming that there is a statewide problem with groundwater. And then based on that assumption, they're singling out exempt well users to solve this unidentified problem. We think that is putting the cart before the horse. Oregon has long had a policy of exempting domestic wells from permitting. The most important reason for that exemption is the fact that it's such a small amount of water use. Less than 1% of the water used in Oregon is exempt wells. And of that, most of that ends up being returned directly to the aquifer after it runs through an on-site septic system. As a matter of fact,
Even the Umatilla County Commissioners, which are struggling with several critical groundwater areas within their jurisdiction, have said, and I'm quoting the resolution they adopted in February of 2005, domestic and other exempt uses of water consume relatively very little of the alluvial and basalt aquifer waters in the critical groundwater areas as compared to non-exempt uses such as that used for municipal, industrial, and agricultural purposes. So that being said, we do question the need for the amendments, which again single out exempt well users to, number one, pay a new fee for groundwater studies and monitoring. We agree with the comments of Mr. Schmidt. Why are you picking on the group that uses the least amount of water to pay this fee? Also, the bill, the Dash 2 amendments, require the, quote, recording of exempt wells. We don't know what recording means. Is that a precursor to some sort of regulation or other taxation? And finally, we're concerned the Dash 2 amendments with the new authority that the commission would have to regulate exempt wells based on ORS 536.340, which speaks to highest and best use and can be classified or reclassified by the commission. So, in conclusion, we cannot support these amendments or this bill because we don't believe that a problem has adequately been identified, and you know, we'd be happy to work with the chair during the interim on this issue, but we do not think that this bill is the solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Harlan. Thank you. I just want to make a comment on your, I think, testimony. As far as the fairness of this fee, actually all the other water users that are registered already pay a fee. There's a base fee of $500 for groundwater that actually was increased from $300 to $500. So they already do pay that, plus they pay per start card. Is that correct? Okay. Any questions for the panel? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next I'm going to call up Sarah Demling, is it? Sarah Demling or Denling?
She was here earlier, and you brought her on.
Okay, so she must have left then. Let's see. I'm looking for other real people that might...
As opposed to a non-real person?
As opposed to all the lobbyists that are on this.
The unreal people.
And we have two right up here that signed up, Frank and John.
John is going to give his time to me, but I'm not going to use any more than my time.
Right? Really, really,
we need
Madam Chair.
A little lightness here for a second again, because you've been working so hard. Committee Administrator, what's your name?
Beth.
Beth, I'm going to ask you a question, and just say no to it. There's no trick to make, there's no trick to make you look foolish or anything.
Okay.
Okay. Right. Did you hear why all blonde jokes are one-liners?
Don't go there.
It's okay. Just say no.
No. No.
Okay. So the men can remember them, especially the bald-headed old man.
All right. Yeah, I like that one.
Okay, I go with this guy who's just sitting here pretty well. Goodbye. Have a good time.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Smith.
Very quickly, I apologize for interruption. I have a housekeeping question. I'm expected to be in another committee right now. On the agenda, do you anticipate a need for me to be down to vote?
If we do, let us know where you are, and we can. Will you be in the building?
I will be. I will be up in 3.
Transportation. Okay, well, he's looking. I'm going to call up the next.
357.
Okay. We certainly will come get you if we
thank
need
you.
To. Thank you. Okay, thank you. See, next I'm going to call up. Let's call up Jim Welsh and John DeVoe and Jeff Stone. This is the non-real people part of the... It's that time of the session now where we, you know...
At least two of us.
Yeah. Oh, you're all lobbyists. It's okay.
Finally got him where you wanted.
Yeah. Oh. Well, that will let John go first because, you know, we're picking on him so much.
Hold on. Chair Dinkfelder, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is John DeVoe. I'm Executive Director of Water Watch of Oregon. As originally drafted, this bill would have required going forward an application for a water right for specific new groundwater uses that are currently defined as exempt. With exempt uses, we have no public interest review, no water availability analysis, or impact or analysis of impact on fisheries. No analysis of the impact of use on neighbors, farmers, cities, or in-stream use. As originally drafted, the bill was an attempt to address a loophole that allowed certain exempt uses to proceed without any analysis of the effects of the use on senior water right holders, surface water users, in-stream users, and groundwater resources. We strongly supported the original version of the bill. We also support the Dash 2 amendments, even though this is a much more limited bill than the original bill. We agree with the concept of reducing the amount of exempt use allowed by certain exempt uses. We also agree with providing the authority for the commission to require permits for proposed uses in groundwater limited and critical groundwater areas. We would propose an amendment to the bill, and that is in section 4A, which states, quote, after classification or reclassification of groundwater pursuant to ORS 536.340 or designation of a critical groundwater area pursuant to ORS 537.730, and we would add the words, or where the potential for substantial interference with surface waters exists, to address the surface water interference concern we have with exempt uses. With that, I'll conclude and just note that we support the bill. I would add one other thing. To date, we have 230,000 plus or minus of these wells in Oregon. If you multiply that number by 15,000 gallons per day currently allowed, you end up with about 3.5 billion gallons of permitted use. Now, obviously, we're not talking about that much actual use. If you add in 230,000 wells times a half acre of allowed irrigation, you end up with something like 287,000 acre-feet of permitted irrigation use on top of that. So we do believe that this is a significant amount of use, probably in excess of the 1% number that we've heard before the committee. But with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you. Jeff.
Madam Chair, Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations at the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I've been called a lot of things this week. Unreal is the kindest. Thank you.
I'll remember that, Jeff. Remember that when you're called other names later in the session.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your kindness on that. The OEN and its members are concerned with the impact of exempt wells on nursery operations, and I've given you written remarks that I will not repeat today. We're supportive of HB 2566, and we think that after talking with the Water Resources Department, with the administrator, we feel comfortable with the direction that this bill is going. We have provided the administrator, Madam Chair, with some suggested refinement in language for the bill that we think helps clarify some of the definitions. But I would just like to bring that to your attention, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Hey, Jim.
Chair Dingfelder and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh representing the Oregon Cattlemen, and I have to tell you, they are very real. You've seen plenty of them here in their hats, and I could have brought plenty more today with me, but we decided that we would address these because we've been involved, and we've been thankful that we've been involved. You involved us in your committee and work group process. And as we went through these and analyzed the changes, we're still perplexed over, you know, trying to resolve a problem and come up with a solution here that probably is best for Oregon. And as we, you know, different groups had different, in the work group, had different areas that they had problems with. And so what we have decided that this needs certainly more time, more scrutiny, and then we have gotten in about three committee hearings and some work groups. I think it's something that we would need to take another 2 years. I've told you that before. And reducing from 15,000 gallons to 5,000 gallons. We're glad that the Dash 2s went up from 3,000 to 5,000, but still, that's a big change. And we're going to codify all this change also. And not necessary to do, as we look at it, we think the department still has plenty of authority to take on any problem areas. And that's what we need to be discussing, the problem areas within the state. And certainly the $250 that a lot of these new property owners and will users are going to be paying, that needs to have the scrutiny, I believe, of Ways and Means Committee. So that should go in that direction. And finally, exempt wells may not have the review that some think within the state, but we also believe that Oregon Water Resource Department provides that type of review. And if they think in an area that there should not be exempt wells, believe me, they're going to classify or reclassify that area because they have the authority. And certainly no need to codify anything further. So we do not support dash ones or dash twos or the original bill.
Thank you very much. Any quick questions on this panel? Oh, we're losing members left and right. Okay, thank you. Next, I'd like to call up, let's see, we have a lot of people still left, and I will call up Kay Finney. Kay Finney? Is that right? Katie Fast and John Chandler. Okay.
Madam Chairman and committee members, my name is Kay Finney, and I live in a rural area, Multnomah County. And my main concern here, I'm no one official, I'm a rural property owner. And this doesn't even apply to me right now. We were fortunate that a few of our neighbors and I were able to go to put in a mile water line to be able to be part of our local water district. But I have lived in rural areas for 25 years, just since I've been married, and I grew up on family farms. Our problem is we are getting so totally overregulated, and I think you're lumping all of us together. You're lumping domestic uses along with people that are, you know, that are just using households, let alone during irrigation. We've dealt with the dirt police in rural Multnomah County, and we've actually had county people following us around to see if we're moving more than 50 cubic yards of dirt, and now we have the water police. I feel I strongly agree with some of the testimony in opposition to these amendments and House Bill 2566. I cannot, in my research that I've done on this, show that there really is a problem here. It's already regulated. You're just over-regulating it, and it's just adding a lot more additional fees. Wells in themselves pretty much regulate themselves. And even on top of these fees, it cost a great deal to go through this process to even get a well. And a lot of the water lines and where the water lines are regulate the capacity of these wells. So I just urge you to rethink this and go back, because I think you are made, this bill makes decisions that just aren't ready to be made.
Thank you. John?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, bringing to this issue the happiness of ignorance. Last time I encountered water law in Oregon was about 25 years ago when I was practicing law, and I'm somewhat pleased to find that it's just as complex as it was then. When this bill was first introduced, it caused my membership a great deal of concern because it seemed it was awfully broad. The dash two amendments in front of you are moving very positively, I believe. But something occurred to me this morning, and I haven't had a chance to share this with any of you individually, but land use is the area I spent most of the sandbox I've played in most of my career in this legislature, and it's an equally contentious and complicated area of law and policy. And I remember a couple, 3 years back, sitting in an LCDC hearing when there was a PowerPoint presentation of all the changes that had taken place in Senate Bill 100 when Moses come down from Mount Sinai with the tablets and all, had happened. And I was sitting in the audience thinking of how many of those changes I'd had hand in, legislatively or through litigation or through some other faction, and Thousand Friends and all the other folks who play in that arena. And as a result of all of our fiddlings over the years with a very complicated issue and taking a piece here and a piece there, we'd gummed it up pretty substantially. Hence the big look that's going forward. That was kind of the genesis of the conversations about the Big Look Task Force. It was a recognition that through legislative effort, litigation, policy discussions, and so on, we complicated an already complicated process. This bill in front of you is taking a piece of a very complicated process, the issue of groundwater. Right now, I listen to the testimony. I've heard a lot of belief statements. I've heard a lot of suppositions. I've seen very little hard evidence that there's a problem, where it is, how it should be managed. I think this is an attempt to get at that problem is very commendable. The fee that's contained in this bill, I don't have any problem with. what the bill is instructing the Water Resources Division to do, Department to do, and what that analysis and study ought to consist of, there's, I think, really does need a little bit more, a few more sideboards. My fear, and the reason for the long story about the land use effort, is we don't want to gum this one up, too. This, in the testimony you've heard, there's been a lot of reference to Measure 37 and to other areas where this is as much a land use conversation as is a water conversation. I'm not sure Water Resources Department is equipped to handle that. I don't have their proxy, but I'd bet you a cookie that they don't want it. If we're going to have a comprehensive conversation about water policy as related to groundwater and usage, which I believe we need based on this bill and the testimony we've heard.
Watch them.
Yeah, get them down here in a hurry. Then I think we need to have a little more sideboards in this legislation. What the study should be done. We talk in the bill about giving this money to do groundwater studies, what those might consist of, where they might be conducted, how they are conducted in terms of other people and other groups' involvement, and more importantly, to have that comprehensive conversation. So we're not just focusing on exempt uses, we're not just focusing on agricultural uses, but we're looking at the panoply of uses as it relates to groundwater. My fear is, Madam Chair and members, without that, we could create a worse problem than the one we have. We are committed to trying to work on this and to keep this effort going forward. We think it's time to have this conversation. Clearly, enough concerns out there. And if there's a way we can help either as in answering questions now or as this moves forward, we'll be happy to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. I appreciate your comment. I will, for the record, state that the good representative from Pendleton, Representative Jensen, in 2005, and myself this session, although I did not end up filing the bill, both had sort of a big look for water law. And if you want to see the fear of God put in people, then you put that out. And, you know, I'm not saying that it's not a good idea, but it is a very, very difficult thing to do unless you have 10, 15 years to look through Oregon water codes. So both the representative and I, if I recall right, had a bill. And that was the response that we received from that effort. But I certainly applaud if you want to forward that.
Madam Chair,
I do believe that it needs a lot of look. This would be the first start because that has been an issue as where it even starts to look at the problem.
Well, in fact, of course, retirement's not imminent, but it's visible for me, so a 15-year project sounds ducky. I just
anyway.
always want to know where the next paycheck's coming from. I think this bill is a good start, Madam Chair. I really do. And I think that the conversation that it's starting is one that apparently is long overdue. My concern simply is, and maybe we don't need to do a big look, you have more comprehensive than I'm fearful here, and not fearful is the wrong word. We don't have enough sideboards in this legislation yet to tell Water Resources Department what is it we want them to do. We give them some money. That's good. I would assume that a little bit more guidance about what and where and when would be warranted.
Yeah, and just so you know, the two representatives here who sit on the Budget Ways and Means Committee, there was a policy option package in the Water Resources Department's budget that was not fully funded for groundwater studies. So,
For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. As I've testified on this committee and the groundwater issue in the past, our membership does have some concerns with conflicts with exempt wells in critical and limited groundwater areas. So we are supportive of Section 1, Sub 4 in the bill that gives the department increased authority in those areas. Currently, the department does have some regulatory authority, but we see that more as a valve to shed off exempt uses in limited and critical groundwater areas. What this amendment would do is it allows the department to have some flexibility when it comes to exempt uses in those areas and allow for permits for new domestic wells going forward. This will require an injury analysis, which we're supportive of having, and having it look at exempt wells and their impact on existing uses within limited and critical groundwater areas. Moving to the fee issue, we do not right now have a solid position on the $250 fee and where that, how that would be funded. I think I share some of the similar concerns with Mr. Chandler on the direct direction to the department and the scope. My rough calculations, you know, brings up that this would generate about $2 million. And that's a huge increase for the department. And we feel the department does a good job managing money. However, we'd like to have continued discussions on their direction for the funding. And I think that can happen in ways and means. So I'd be supportive, and Farm Bureau would be supportive of these amendments being drafted and we having continued discussions with the Ways and Means Subcommittee on their study work and implementation of the bill.
Thank you, Katie. Question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Katie, you referred to Section 1, Subsection 4A, which I presume what you're referring to is on page 3 of the Dash 2 Amendment, starting at line 22.
Yes.
Would you help me understand, please, what you said that subsection does is give the department or the commission additional authorities. Would you please tell me what those additional authorities are?
Correct. If you look at line 25, it allows that the Water Resources Commission may require that any person attending to use groundwater from a source. So it requires that they may require a permit in those areas. It doesn't force those areas to have permit applications, but the department can look at, I think, some of the studies that they'll be doing with the funding source, that they feel that this needs an additional level of security for the existing water users and require a permit in those areas. It doesn't require that they will always require a permit in those areas. So if they have an area that's having a large number of complaints, they're seeing aquifer challenges in that critical groundwater area, they're starting to regulate off existing uses, they might decide it's time, instead of just shutting the area off for new exempt uses, allowing people to still apply for a permit, so allowing exempt uses to go forward as long as they're not going to impact existing water users.
Follow up. During a work group, I commented that, and I certainly am not the attorney here and the water law expert, but it seems very apparent to me that the commission already has the authority to do this type of stuff. I would submit and challenge anybody in this room that's the attorney to tell me otherwise, that even though it may not specifically say that they could require a permit, the way I read this, for example, under the critical groundwater area section, a rule by the commission may include any one or more of the following control provisions, including closing it and everything else. So is there anything in the statute now that would preclude the commission from requiring a permit? My point being, you know, as I said in the working group, I'm just not convinced yet that there's a problem that's been clearly articulated, that this bill is addressing that problem. And furthermore, I don't understand why, with the authorities that the commission has right now in statute, if and when the problems exist, why aren't they dealing with it?
I'll respond. My conversations I've had with the department is, and I would encourage you to bring them up, is that they do not have that ability right now. It is either exempt wells moving forward or completely shutting an area off.
Okay. I will bring the department up, but we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure that everybody can get up here, and then we'll bring the department up to answer that. Thank you.
One quick comment following up on Representative Burley's question, and I meant to mention this in my main testimony. We do have concern about that section as well. If I understand the intent, is to, we, instead of the on-off switch, we have a rheostat. The guidance for where those stops are within that still would, I'd want to have more conversation with the department if we're going to agree to the permit process, simply because if there's a loop we get caught in, that's where it's going to be. And I share the Representative Burley's concern about how this would expand existing authority or if it's necessary.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may just quickly follow up on that. I know you want to go, but I'm willing to stay because this is a pretty important measure, I think. Okay, so we make them get a permit. So what? What's that accomplished? Nothing. It's cost more money, impact on the department. Really, what's important are the rules that the commission promulgates when you've got these critical areas. why isn't the commission dealing with the problem? That's what I want to know. Why aren't they promulgating the rules?
Why don't we have the Water Resources Department come up? Thank you, panel. And then we'll hear the rest of the witnesses.
You have to go.
Yes. Sorry. The chair is...
Just give me the gavel.
Yeah. We'll have a committee of one here in about a minute, so, or 5 minutes. Debbie, if you could try to address the concern that Representative Burley raised, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, I think your first question was, does the commission already have the authority to make these exempt users go to our permitting approach? And when we look at our authorities under the critical groundwater authorities and also under classifications, we don't think that we have a direct authority to make those exempt users go through our permit application process. And it certainly the legislature could give us that explicit authority along the lines of these Dash 2 amendments. And I think another question that you raised was, you know, what does it achieve to have those exempt users now go through a permitting process? And I just kind of go back to Katie Fast's comment that when it goes through a permit review process, that's when our department would look to see, is there water available to support the use? Would it result in injury to other users? Would it be hydraulically connected to surface water with potential for substantial interference with those surface waters? And do that kind of review process as part of our regular permitting approach.
Well, follow up for question.
Quick follow up, yep.
You know, under 537.545, which is the exempt uses, the very last subsection, item 3 says, if it is necessary for the department to regulate the use or distribution of groundwater, including uses exempt under subsection 1. Okay, so if it's necessary for them to do it, then it goes on to say that the department shall use as a priority date for the exempt uses, blah, blah, blah. So, okay, so what, under this thing, we make them get a permit. So what? What does that accomplish? If we're going to regulate the use, if we have a problem, the permit in and of itself is not going to solve the problem. It's the rules and the regulations that the commission are going to impose in that area. Is that an accurate statement?
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right that we have existing authority to regulate those exempt uses by priority date, and the priority date we use is the date they submitted those well logs.
So then follow up, if I may, and I promise it will be my last question. Mm-hmm. What then exactly is the purpose of making them get a permit? What does that accomplish?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think what that the intent there might be is to have them go through those different criteria that we use during our regular permitting process.
Yeah, and if I can clarify, Representative Burley, for existing wells, that means that you know, the department can require that they are shut down or whatever. For new wells right now, if somebody comes on for an exemption, they don't have to go through any process with the department. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
There's no injury.
There's no application review process.
Okay, but again, in the law right now, if you have a groundwater critical area and the commission has adopted rules for it, those rules can control the distribution and withdrawal of water by the day, by the week, by the month, by the year.
It's prospective.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. Where we have designated those areas, we can restrictively classify those types of uses, or we can prevent further exemptions within those areas.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, we'll call up the last couple folks here, Debbie Lane, Willie Tiffany, and Amanda Rich, and then we have one more panel after that, and we are going to need to shut down the hearing. If you state your name for the record, please.
My name is Debbie Lau, L-A-U-E. Oh,
sorry.
That's okay. Common mistake. I'm out of Wilsonville, Oregon, and I worked in the Parrot Mountain area, which is between Sherwood, Wilsonville, and Newburgh in the early 90s when there was a groundwater concern. And basically, a small group of landowners that had shallow wells were able to shut down a development that wanted to come into the area based on groundwater concerns. So for 2 years, the state studied the area. They came to the conclusion there was plenty of water if you drilled deep enough. So the people had drilled into a shallow pocket of water, not an aquifer, may have been having some problems, but in the meantime, all the people that owned property in the area could not drill wells, caused them a much bigger problem. And for years afterwards, 10 to 12 years afterwards, there was a thought process that Parrot Mountain didn't have water. I ran into that constantly. So you got to be careful, you know, and coming up with these things a little too quickly, because those thought processes last a long time in an area where there may be plenty of water, but some group of people, and I heard the testimony from Eola Hills, you know, their whatever it was, their petition saying they were concerned about groundwater. Well, there's maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but I think that more study needs to be done, and I think that this is moving a little too quickly. Thank you.
Thank you. Amanda?
Madam Chair, Representative Burley, my name is Amanda Rich, and I'm representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. And just very briefly, our main concerns about the original bill were impacts on the Water Resources Department in terms of their time and resources, and I believe that that has been definitely addressed in the Dash 2 amendments, and we are supportive of the Dash 2 amendments to the bill.
Okay, thank you. Willie?
Thank you for the record. Willie Tiffany at the League of Oregon Cities. I will be as brief as Amanda in the interest of time. We also are supportive. I want to thank both of you for your leadership on the work group. I thought that was a good process. And the Dash 2 amendments have come a long way. We're very, very happy to support them. We think they go in the right direction. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And we have one last group of people. Anita Winkler. Is Anita here? Richard Kosasan and Ross Day. Yes.
Would you like us to go ahead while they're getting?
Go ahead.
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, and the absent members of the committee at this point. I probably Amanda and Willie and I should have just given you a short note that we had some concerns very similar to what Amanda has said theirs were with the a bill as originally drafted. The Dash 2 resolves our issues, and I also want to thank both of you. I know that some of those work group sessions were a little tough and a little long, and I think that what you have in front of you is a very accurate and good reflection of what the work group talked about.
Thank you. Richard?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder, Representative Burley, and Administrator Beth.
2 minutes is going, so Richard, you may want to...
I passed out a couple of pieces. One would include Water for Life's comments with respect to the bill, the Dash 2 amendments, and two, the statutory provisions applicable, I believe, to the management of groundwater resources. Water for Life would maintain a very strong contention that the department and the commission do indeed have the authority currently to manage the resource. But in terms of the drafting of the Dash 2 amendments, I would point to a couple of things. One, the language in page 3, lines 22 through 30, 4A, after classification or reclassification of groundwater, and you can continue with that. Basically, upon a classification or reclassification, the commission would be afforded the authority to reach back and impact an existing exempt use. And again, the language contained in Section 2, both subsections 1, subsections 2, if read literally, they would afford the commission again the authority to retroactively reach back and impact, quote, an exempt use. And with respect to the exempt use, I think one section that should be highlighted very clearly would be found in 537, 545, subsection 2. An exempt use is an exempt use, but it represents clearly, and it always was intended to represent a right. The use of groundwater for a use exempt under subsection 1 of this section, to the extent that it is beneficial, constitute a right to appropriate groundwater equal to that established by a groundwater right certificate. So we talk about these.
You can wrap up, please. Yeah.
Well, I would encourage the committee to look at, I think, the statutory authorities and Water for Life's comments. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Day.
Thank you.
You get to
wrap up. I'll be brief. Again, Ross Day of Oregonians in Action. I just want to echo the comments of Mr. Kostazan, Mr. Schmidt, Mr. Levy, and others who spoke out against the Dash 2 amendments. Oregonians in Action as well opposes not only the original bill, but the Dash 2 amendments as well, primarily because we feel this is really a solution that's looking for a problem that doesn't exist. You heard Mr. Ashkin talk about exempt wells being nothing more than de minimis uses. I don't know why we're talking about regulating de minimis uses. And lastly, I just want to point out and kind of highlight what Mr. Kostazan was just talking about in Section 2 of the bill. I do believe, as applied, these are also retroactive to folks who maybe had not filed a water log, you know, prior to when water logs were originally required. They're going to get hit with a $250 bill, at least according to the express language of Section 2. So I think the committee needs to take a look at that again and make sure that the language is clear, because as far as I can tell, with my lawyer glasses on here, these are retroactive.
Yes.
That's all I have.
Great. Thank you very much. Okay, with that, and seeing that we've lost all our committee members for the chair and vice chair, we will close the public hearing in House Bill 2566 and close the House Energy and Environment Committee. Okay.